This is number 0079, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0079. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Stacy Schiff, who is the author of Cleopatra, A Life. Who exactly was Cleopatra?
A woman who is a master strategist who manages to indeed enter into alliances with and have children with both Caesar and Mark Antony, two of the most powerful Romans of the day, but who does it not because she's a great seductress, but because this is part of her political program. This is a shrewd, clever, working queen who had a very difficult country to rule at a very, very turbulent time, and who manages to somehow make her way through two decades of famine and war and plague very ably.
Mike Spry is the managing director of the Summer Literary Series. What's the series about, and how long has it been going on?
We've been doing this for about 12 years, since 98, when our first program was in St. Petersburg. We bring together writers, established writers from all over the world, to different venues, and we spend 2 weeks with younger emerging writers and doing workshops and lectures and panels and just discussing writing and discussing the writing community and trying to do our best to embolden and enrich those communities.
Chris Aragon from the website baconisbomb.com shares what his site has to offer.
It's basically a site that deals with all things bacon. Bacon creations that are both edible and not, but it's heavily focused on bacon photos and bacon videos. We've got everything from girls in bacon bikinis to a bacon Obama rap video. And it is a rap video dedicated to both Obama and bacon.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff. And of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0079, is Barry Donnelly, cameraman from Global National News, and the proud new father of little Quinn Harper, who already has him wrapped around her little fingers. Thank you very much, Barry, for doing the slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the Stuff File news, shall we? Well, Valentine's Day has come and gone, and usually I don't talk about the Hallmark Propaganda Day, but I thought I would share this story. Think of it as a world-breaking embrace for love and mankind. In Pattaya, Thailand, seven couples lock lips for more than 33 hours to celebrate Valentine's Day in a kissing contest. Organizers claim it's the longest recorded smooch in history. The previous record, 32 hours, 7 minutes, and 14 seconds, was set in 2009 by a couple in Germany, according to the Guinness World Records folks. The contest kicked off Sunday morning at 6 a.m., and by Monday afternoon, half were still kissing away in the shopping mall, while spectators gawked and smiled at the spectacle. The last couple left kissing won a diamond ring worth $1,600 and a cash prize worth about $3,200. Now, according to the rules, the lovebirds' lips could not part at any time. They were allowed to drink water, coffee, milk, or juice, but only through straws while continuing to kiss. They also had to remain embraced during bathroom breaks, possibly every 3 hours, and accompanied by contest monitors. The harshest rule, no sitting or sleeping. One woman participating with her boyfriend fainted after just a half hour. Wimp. Ironically, despite its reputation for having one of the biggest sex industries in the world, Thailand is still a conservative nation where kissing in public, even a small peck, is frowned upon. Participants had to show proof that they were either married or truly a couple. A letter from both parents or a marriage certificate was acceptable. Now tell me, whose parents in any culture signs off on that? I'm just asking. Meanwhile, in Strasbourg, Germany, firefighters risked their lives while attempting a dangerous nighttime rescue of a swan who had become stuck in a frozen pond. A total of 25 firefighters were scrambled to save the bird in an operation which put them literally on thin ice. They finally reached their half-frozen feathered friend, and that's when they found out that it was merely a plastic decoy left behind by a hunter. Oh well, fortunately, nobody was injured, and at least the firefighters got a bit of training in. In Pontiac, Michigan, a woman's obesity proved to be her undoing when she attempted to rob an electronics store. 30-year-old Jerry Perkins stands in at 5'2" tall and weighs in at 400 pounds. As a result, she uses one of those power scooters to get around. But after attempting to scooter off with $600 worth of electronics merchandise, her scooter got stuck and she couldn't make it out the door. Yeah, it's the scooter that got stuck. The door alarm was activated when she passed through it, and the store employees approached her asking for a receipt for the items. She responded by shoving one of the security officers and then hit her in the face. A sheriff's deputy arrived and asked Perkins to put her hands behind her back, and she cursed at the deputy, balled her right hand into a fist, and took a fighting stance. Again, she's 5'2" and weighs 400 pounds and is in a scooter. Fighting stance. Anyway, the deputy pulled out a taser and told Perkins to put her hands behind her back. But Perkins brought her fists up over her head and looked directly at the deputy, so he tased her. She then suddenly decided it would be a good idea to cooperate with the deputy and let him arrest her and take her to jail. Now, I know it's not politically correct to state this, but let's be honest. One has to know their limitations. If you're 5'2" and weigh 400 pounds, there are some careers you might want to eliminate from your choices. Off the top of my head, two come to mind. Robber, because it makes the getaways difficult. And jockey, although in this case, all the difficulties lie with the horse. But the winner's circle is pretty much out of the question, don't you think? Yeah. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News with me, Peter Anthony Holder, in Sarasota, Florida, 33-year-old Neil Lansing, who's homeless, was arrested while appearing in court due to what was hidden inside his body while he stood before the judge. Deputies conducting a routine search found part of a condom sticking out of Lansing's backside, which contained 17 round blue pills, one cigarette, 6 matches, one flint, one empty syringe with an eraser over the needle, one lip balm container, one additional unused condom, a receipt from CVS Pharmacy, and a paper coupon. So now he faces charges of possessing a drug and a tobacco product inside the Sarasota County Jail. Boy, the term bumming a cigarette means so many different things in this case, doesn't it? Yeah. On to our first guest on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. What do we really know about Cleopatra? Well, let's find out some more information about the last queen of Egypt. Joining us on the program is Stacy Schiff, and she's the author of Cleopatra, A Life. Hi, Stacy.
Hi, how are you, Peter?
I'm fine. Thanks for being on the program. There has been so much written and said about Cleopatra. At what point did you say, you know what, I have new information or definitive information, I've got to write this book?
Well, you know, I think what happened was I kept reading and rereading the ancient sources and realizing that everything we know is wrong, basically. Here's a woman whom we think of as Egyptian, but she was in fact Greek. Here's a woman whom we think of as beautiful, who was anything but. Here's a woman whom we think of as a seductress, who was in fact a master strategist. So really, I came to this a little bit appalled by my own ignorance and eager to correct the historical record.
You mentioned a lot of is made of her beauty, and your book, I understand, has been optioned as a film.
That's right.
And there is talk that Angelina Jolie, yet another beauty, is...
I like to think she has bad hair days every once in a while.
She is slated to play a Cleopatra. And it's so, you know, you go from Angelina Jolie to Elizabeth Taylor. They're all beauties. I guess you can't put an ugly woman in a movie.
This is true, but what you need for this book, what you need for a real Cleopatra, is a woman who, as the ancient chroniclers make clear, alters the room the minute she walks in, alters the temperature of the room the minute she walks in. You need someone larger than life, immensely charismatic, you know, hugely present. And that's a pretty short list of actresses right there.
Also, from what we know about Cleopatra, aren't all the actresses and all the depictions we know of Cleopatra older than she really was?
Not necessarily. necessarily older, but there are very few depictions we have of Cleopatra which can be authenticated. And the only ones to which we can really trust are the coin portraits, which Cleopatra herself would have signed off on, and which are fairly consistent from one to the next. And those do show us a woman who is very angular-featured, with a hooked nose, a very prominent chin, sunken eyes, definitely not an Elizabeth Taylor look-alike. And those are the portraits with which she presented herself, by which she presented herself to her subjects.
So what is the biggest misconception that we have about Cleopatra?
Well, I think in addition to those, what we often forget, in addition to the beauty and the fact that she's of Greek ancestry, we often forget how rich she was. This is the wealthiest person, hands down, in the Mediterranean world. And I think that went a great way to her allure to the Romans, certainly. And a woman who is a master strategist, who manages to indeed enter into alliances with and have children with both Caesar and Mark Antony, two of the most powerful Romans of the day, but who does it not because she's a great seductress, but because this is part of her political program. This is a shrewd, clever, working queen who had a very difficult country to rule at a very, very turbulent time, and who manages to somehow make her way through 2 decades of famine and war and plague very ably.
She also spoke several languages, didn't she?
According to Plutarch, Cleopatra spoke 9 languages, and perhaps more shockingly, she is apparently the first of her dynasty, who had been ruling Egypt for 300-odd years, to speak Egyptian. The other Ptolemies had never spoken the language of the people over whom they rule, whereas Cleopatra does, which may well account for her seeming popularity with the people of southern Egypt.
And we spend so much time in this day and age talking about the difference between men and women and the role of men and women in society. What was it like, generally speaking, for Cleopatra, being a woman?
Well, this was one of the astonishments to me, and I hadn't counted on this when I began researching her life. Women in Egypt, well before Cleopatra, are immensely empowered. They are allowed to enter into their own marriages. They have the right to divorce. They inherit equally. It's been suggested that as much as a third of Egypt may have been in female hands because women could own businesses and could inherit property. And they clearly own papyrus marshes and hire flute players and own barges. They really enjoy extraordinary rights that women won't again have until the 20th century. So on the one hand, there is this sense of equality. On the other, there had been prior female sovereigns. The difference with Cleopatra VII, with this Cleopatra, is that she, unlike her predecessors, manages to rule Egypt single-handedly, which was quite a twist on the theme. Usually you had to have a male consort of some kind. And what Cleopatra very cleverly does is to install her young son by Caesar, Caesarion, at her side. And being an infant for much of this time, or a child for much of this time, he's not likely to meddle in any way with her agenda.
So when did situations for women change?
Basically when the Romans take over. Under Roman rule, Egypt, after Cleopatra's death, Egypt becomes a province of Rome, is annexed to the Roman Empire. And under any kind of Roman administration, obviously women went, the world went back to being a very masculine, very military place. So that wonderful moment in history essentially comes to an end there. There's some evidence that some of the empresses, some of the wives of the Roman emperors, enjoy certain liberties, travel with their husbands, and have huge staffs, have their images carved because of the effect of Cleopatra, because of the power that Cleopatra had wielded. But that's somewhat speculative. We're not sure that that's really cause and effect there.
When you started this project, were you did you ever anticipate, quite frankly, the kind of buzz that it would generate? I mean, I understand options for movies were started before your book was even finished. I've seen you being interviewed in several places. There's a lot of buzz about your book.
In a word, no. It never. I think every writer is always surprised when anyone wants to read anything he or she writes. And for much of this time, I think I worked on this for about 4 or 5 years, I was very apologetic when people asked what I was writing about, and I would sort of say, "Don't laugh, Cleopatra." So. No, I'm pleasantly surprised, obviously, but quite astounded that it seems to have hit a nerve. And I write that down partly to just our human desire to want to solve a mystery. Here's a story with a lot of holes in it, and I think that lack of resolution really is an attractive thing.
What was the biggest revelation for you in doing the research on Cleopatra?
I think I was amazed by how shrewd and resolute Cleopatra is when she comes to meet Caesar for the first time, a story which, if you remember your Elizabeth Taylor, she does in a carpet, but in fact she does in a canvas sack. She has actually had to make her way in from the eastern Sinai, where she's been exiled, where she's holding court with a mercenary army that she has raised in the desert. She has to make her way back to the Palace of Alexandria undetected, probably up and then down the Nile, under the palace walls, and into the palace to meet Caesar. This is a very, very ingenious woman who is able to, as Plutarch points out, adapt herself to any audience very ably, but who is immensely resourceful. And at the end of her life as well, when she's pretty much backed into a corner, you can see that ingenuity at work. This is a woman who is extremely well-educated, clearly lightning quick, and enormously resourceful at all times.
She did during her lifetime actually marry some of her own brothers, which was not uncommon, I understand.
It was something that, and no one really knows the reason for this. The Ptolemies, her dynasty, it practiced sibling marriage, so that by the time Cleopatra rolls around, I think 10 or 11 of the previous 15 Ptolemaic marriages had been between siblings. And in fact, Cleopatra's parents are almost certainly brother and sister. She, however, is put on the throne with a brother who is 10 years old. So although they are nominally husband and wife, it's very difficult to imagine that they were anything but nominally husband and wife.
So there was a lot of love between the family, but she also bumped off one or two, did she not?
Yeah, no, that's the great. There too, the ingenuity, or at least the determination, the ruthlessness is clear. She's left with three siblings, one of whom conveniently dies in a civil war against her, which is when Caesar has entered the picture. The second of whom is exiled to modern-day Turkey, and ultimately Mark Antony will have her murdered as a favor of Cleopatra. And the third of whom is another younger brother, whom she's nominally again put on the throne with later, and whom she allegedly will poison. So it's a pretty bloody history, although as the ancient commentators point out, that was pretty much standard operating procedure among dynasts at the time.
So it was your intent to get the story straight when starting this book, Cleopatra, A Life. Now that it has been optioned as a film, do you have any say in how it's made?
No, I get to write the book and then I get to go on and write another book. But, you know, it's interesting because I think we all invent our own Cleopatras to some extent once we get to, you know, the comic book version or the film version. I think when you're saying I'm writing a book of nonfiction, I'm writing a biography, the results are by definition different than what you're going to wind up with on the screen.
The book is called Cleopatra, A Life. It's written by Stacey Schiff. And Stacey, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Entirely my pleasure. Thank you.
Stacey Schiff, author of Cleopatra, A Life. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, click on the Stuff File program, and then the episode number for this show, which is number 0079. And you'll find links to Stacey's website and to also either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands, just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Choosy mothers choose the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. If your mother didn't choose it for you, well, I guess she just doesn't love you.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about summer literary seminars, plus we'll talk about bacon. And of course, we have an idiot of the day coming your way. But right now, more Stuff File news for your listening pleasure. And you know, while many communities are turning to noise ordinances to keep the peace, Germany is going the other way, at least for little kids. Germany is so desperate to encourage people to have more children that the government is proposing a bill allowing citizens under the age of 6 to laugh, shout, and play at any volume. Germany is known as the land of many rules, especially about noise, and the government's move comes after a series of lawsuits about children and noise, including one which seeks to ban kindergartens from residential areas because they are too loud. Okay, if you don't have kindergartens in your neighborhood, how far do you plan to send kids to go to kindergarten? That's what I want to know. Anyway, the government says the proposed law would exempt children from strict regulations on noise limits, which force construction sites to stand idle for hours at midday and prohibit mowing the lawns on Sunday. Gee, you know, a country with a rule for just about everything, and you wonder why there's a shortage of kids. Yeah. Anyway, I just want to take a brief moment for a shout-out to China Airlines. You know, this show is heard aboard China Airlines for its long-haul dynasty flights. I understand Maggie Lin from China Airlines listens to the show every week very closely, scouring the program for airline stories. Well, fear not, Maggie. There are no airline stories in the show this week. But we do have a story from your part of the world. Suffering from migraines? Don't underestimate the possibility that it could be a 4-inch knife blade stuck in your brain that doctors missed years ago. It happened in China, and the victim was Li Fu from Yunnan Province, who was stabbed during a robbery in 2006 and had the blade of a knife lodged in his cranium. But despite receiving treatment for his injuries at the time, doctors inexplicably failed to notice the knife buried deep in the 37-year-old's skull. Only last month, when Li visited doctors complaining of migraines, did they finally make the amazing discovery after a routine x-ray. Surgeons removed the blade and Li's going to be fine. His doctor at People's Hospital said he had never seen anything so bizarre in his entire life. You know, all I want to know is if the doctors who missed this 4 years ago are still practicing. That's what concerns me. That would be scary. In Allen Township, Pennsylvania, police have arrested local businessman 43-year-old Rip Van Schwartz, who they say was placing the calls all over the county, all over the country, for the past 5 years, sometimes exceeding 400 calls a day, and trying to get women to talk to him about their pantyhose. Originally, police were investigating calls being made at one local business, but then discovered that Schwartz was allegedly placing calls nationwide. Pantyhose Boy ultimately turned himself in and was arraigned on 21 counts of harassment and released on bail with the condition that he not call or visit Hooters, Bob Evans, Applebee's, or First National Bank of Marysville. Those are all the places he apparently made phone calls to. Gee, do you think this guy has issues? I'm just saying. And no interrogation needed here. In Lykens, Pennsylvania, police pulled over 34-year-old Conrad A. Schutt, who immediately threw his arms into the air and reported he'd stolen the car. He said, "I don't have a license. I stole the car." And then he added, "I always do dumb stuff when I'm drunk." So he was arrested and charged with auto theft and DUI. If only all criminals made it so easy, huh? Yeah. You know, the thing that also I've said on this program time and time again Have you noticed every time somebody does something stupid with a car, any kind of automotive vehicle, they usually don't have a license or have a suspended license? It's funny how that always happens, huh? And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest on the program, Ken Lloyd and his wife visited the Royal Signals Museum in Blandford Garrison in England and bought a plastic toy souvenir, a signaler crouching figurine. But at the airport, an airport security agent decided the package was suspicious due to the toy soldier's 3-inch-long clear plastic gun. Again, clear plastic toy soldier and his gun. So she declared it a firearm. She called her supervisor, who forced the couple to return to the airport concourse to mail the toy home in a padded envelope. The package took 5 days to arrive at Lloyd's home here in Canada. A spokesman for the Royal Signals Museum commented, "It's probably just as well we didn't sell her the toy tank." Wow. The gun wasn't loaded because, you know, it's plastic and a toy. But you have to wonder if the security agents were loaded, because that's just dumb. You know, they almost made Idiot of the Day on this week's show, but they didn't. That comes later. Wait for it. In the meantime, let's get to our next guest on the program, shall we? The Summer Literary Seminars brings the best contemporary writers together. It was recently in Kenya. Later this year, it'll be in Lithuania. And this summer, it will be making a stop right here in Montreal, Canada. Joining us on the line to share with us what this program is all about is Mike Spry, who is the program's managing director. Hi, Mike.
How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the program. So this is a rather interesting gathering of people. Explain to us what the Summer Literary Seminars are all about.
Well, we've been doing this for about 12 years, since 98, when our first program was in St. Petersburg. And we bring together writers, you know. I mean, that's putting it in the most simple of terms. We bring established writers from all over the world to different venues, and we spend 2 weeks with younger emerging writers and doing workshops and lectures and panels and just discussing writing and discussing the writing community and just trying to do our best to embolden and enrich those communities, the ones we're in for the programs and the ones that our participants and our faculties come from.
Now, you say the first one was about a dozen years ago in St. Petersburg. Why St. Petersburg, first of all?
Well, our founder and executive program director, Professor Mikhail Yassel, he's from St. Petersburg, and he wanted to go back. And he had been in the United States for quite a while. He lives here in Montreal now. And he wanted to go back, and he wanted to bring writers with him to share a city that had informed so much of his life and his writing, and a city with a rich, rich literary history and a very strange and beautifully chaotic place in its own right. And it started with, I believe, about a dozen students, and eventually grew up to a one-month program where we had 120 students. So, and since then we expanded and we went to Kenya, another place that Professor Yossel is a big fan of, and Lithuania, where he had spent some time when he was younger. And then natural progression was to bring it home to Montreal, where you know, the two of us spend most of our time.
Now, this coming summer's edition is not the first year here in Montreal, so give us a little taste of, for those who might be coming to town with the Summer Literary Seminars, would be experiencing coming here, for instance.
Well, this is our second one. We did one last June, and it was a lot of fun to bring in writers to our hometown and just show off Montreal. And what can they expect? They can expect a good time first. It's amazing when you realize how few people have actually made their way up to Montreal. You know, we had a bunch of people even from New York and the Northeast states, and they had never been here, and they're amazed at, you know, the beauty and excitement around the city. And they'll be here for 2 weeks with us, from June 12th to 25th. They'll be working with writers like Tony Hoagland and Mary Gateskill, on poetry and fiction. We have screenwriting workshops and creative nonfiction workshops, and then lots of panels and lectures with industry professionals, writers, and editors and publishers from all around Canada and the United States. And and readings from some of the most interesting and dynamic writers, you know, working in North America today. And you know, after the day is done, and it's an intense program, there's a lot of work, and the days of once the workshopping and the lectures and the panels and the readings are over, then, you know, we descend on the city and we go out into Montreal and we sit together and we continue to discuss writing and where our writing comes from and where we come from and where we see writing as a, you know, as the international community of writers, where we see it going.
How long generally are the literary seminars? How many days?
Well, they're 2-week programs. We have a bit of a template where Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays we do, those are the big workshopping days. Tuesdays and Thursdays are the days where there's lots of lectures and panels and stuff of that nature. And then at night we have the readings, and it's all based, the Montreal program based here on the campus of Concordia University. And then we have a lot of less formal events. You know, we always have a great group of volunteers, locals who work as interns with the program, and you know, they take people down to the you know, to the Saint Jean Baptiste Day parade, and they take people out around the city and up to the mountain. And so people who are new to the city, they get to see it from a local's point of view, you know, all within the context of writing.
Depending upon the type of writing some people do, writing can be a somewhat insulating profession. Sometimes it's hard to get writers out of their shell, per se. So this must be an experience, be it Montreal or St. Petersburg or wherever your seminars lead, getting people out amongst other people.
Well, and that's part of our mandate, is that we like to take writers out of their comfort zone. We believe that once you take people from their community, from where they normally write, where they normally work, and you take them out into these strange and interesting and wonderful places, like Kenya, like Montreal, like St. Petersburg, like Vilnius, Lithuania, and you take them out of that comfort zone and you introduce them to other people who have come out of their comfort zone and bring in these great, talented writers to work with them. It's amazing to watch that transition because, you know, all of us who run the program, we're writers ourselves, you know, and so we understand that it is a solitary profession. But to see people come out and come out of their shell a bit and get out and travel and interact with the community in a way that they never would previously. And there's no other organization that gives them this opportunity to see that happen and see the dynamic and the group change over the course of 2 weeks and develop quickly and the friendships that go on afterwards. It's quite an amazing experience, both as a participant, which I was in 2006 in St. Petersburg, and then running the logistics of the program for the last 3 years.
Okay, so as a writer yourself, what has, and not from the organization part of it for you, but as a writer, what has the experience done for you and your writing?
Well, 2006, I went to St. Petersburg because Mikhail, I was in a creative writing program at Concordia, and Mikhail was one of my profs, and he invited me to go, and I was fortunate enough to work with the American writer Padgett Powell, and he did more for my writing in 2 weeks than most people have done in 2 degrees. I've a BA and an MA from Concordia, and I've certainly enjoyed my time here. But to work with Padgett, and he was a writer who I had admired and who I'd read, and Mikhail had given me many of his books, and I was just so excited by his writing. So to sit in a room with him, one, was an exciting endeavor. And then because it's this 2-week intense period, you know, you get right down to it. You get your hands dirty in the writing, and so you end up learning so much more about yourself and about your writing than you do in a 12-week semester or something of that nature. And then even beyond the workshop with Padgett was the fact that the only writing community I had known was the one at Concordia and in Montreal. And so it was really interesting to get out and hang out with people from Tucson, people from Copenhagen, people from Kenya, people from Cleveland, people from New York, people from Los Angeles, people from Vancouver, who were all in similar communities to mine all around the world. And here we are in St. Petersburg with these common experience, having this amazing new common experience. And it kind of, it reminded me that, you know, that, that writing is an amazing thing, and there was other people doing it, and it got me really excited about being a writer, because when I was there, I was a younger writer. I'd only been doing it a few years. I wasn't sure what it all meant, and the program got me excited about it, and it got me ready to venture out into the world as a writer. You know?
Are the summer literary seminars open to everyone?
Everybody. The only we ask for a writing sample with your application, and we also ask that you be older than 18 years. But other than that, it's open to everyone. We do ask for a writing sample to maintain the integrity of the program and the workshops, but it's very open. We're very inclusive. You know, we've had a great, over 1,000 writers have come for this program in 12 years, and it's always been great, and great participants, and I think for the most part, people have come and had a good experience.
What is the cost to participate in the seminars?
The cost for the two-week program for tuition is $1,950 U.S.
Okay.
We have a contest which runs until February 28th. Judges are Mary Gateskill and Matthew Zapruder, and it's a contest we run every year, and we get a great, great turnout. And through that contest, besides the winners in each category who receive tuition, flight, and accommodation to the program of their choice, we also give out merit-based fellowships. So if there's writing that the judges believe is good and is strong and promising, and they believe that that writer, even though they didn't win, would benefit from the SLS experience, then we offer them a fellowship of 20 to 30% off tuition. Because at the end of the day, we want people to join us in these different places. We want other writers to come and visit with us and to improve their writing and to have these experiences.
And you mentioned the location of their choice. Montreal is coming up. I mentioned Lithuania. Kenya was just recently. How many do you have a year?
We always have two a year. This year will be the first year we've done three, so we will be in Montreal June 12th to 25th, and then August 31st July 31st to August 13th we'll be in Vilnius, Lithuania, and then in December from the 3rd to the 21st, I believe we'll be back in Nairobi and Lamu, Kenya.
And people can find out more information by going to your website, and that website is
www.sumlitsem.org.
That's www.sumlitsem.org. I thank you very, very much, Mike, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me, and anytime.
That's Mike Spry from the Summer Literary Seminars. Again, you can check out their website at sumlitsem.org. You can find the links to their site by going to mine at thestufffile.com. Just click on the Stuff File program page and then go and find the episode number for this show, which is show number 0079, and you'll find all the information. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Are you an entrepreneur? In other words, are you a risk-taker willing to run with an idea and turn it into a business, even in the face of great odds? For centuries, our economy has been fueled by forward-thinking entrepreneurs like Henry Ford, Bill Gates, and Oprah Winfrey, just to name a few. But every year, there are about 500,000 other entrepreneurs throughout the United States who also start businesses. They create an enormous number of jobs, so it's extremely important to help them succeed. Today, some government leaders across the nation are working to attract these risk-takers to their communities by removing barriers to their success. Barriers like too much regulation, too much taxation, and too much litigation. Let's be fair, without entrepreneurs, our economy doesn't recover and flourish. If you're one of these risk-takers, or if you want to bring jobs to your community, I'd like to introduce you to John Tyler of the Kauffman Foundation and others like him who are finding innovative ways to help entrepreneurs. Learn more. Go to our website at centerforamerica.org.
What are they saying about if the rains don't cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up?
If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Abidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. If you're listening to this while walking with your iPod, make sure you look both ways before you cross the street. It's safety first on The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we will talk about bacon. And also we'll have an idiot of the day and some more Stuff File news. But I have another quick shout out that I want to do here. And this quick shout out is about the Amazon Kindle. I recently purchased one of these, and this has got to be one of the greatest things since the invention of the printing press. If you like to read, I suggest you check one out. I was never a voracious reader, but now I just can't stop reading. As a matter of fact, I wrote a blog piece about the topic of the Kindle, and you might want to check that out. You can go to the Stuff File website for this show, which is show number 0079, and I put a link in so that you can check out the story I wrote about the Kindle and the joys of reading one. And if you already have one, you know what I'm talking about, don't you? It's great. It's phenomenal. Anyway, Stuff File news story I want to share with you. A suburban Chicago high school health class instructor's technique for teaching the names of female reproductive parts caught the ire of the Illinois Family Institute religious organization in January. Now, to some of the kids, teacher Jacqueline Levine's game was nothing more than a mnemonic to facilitate memorizing the anatomy. But others told the Institute that Levine's play on words was chantable, could be set to the tune of the Hokey Pokey, and was referred to by several students as the vagina dance. Said a complaining parent, "It is disrespectful to women and removes modesty about the reproductive parts." You put your left foot in, you put your left foot out. Yeah, I could see how this would be a problem. Moving right along, ever get yourself into a deeper mess because you can't find the remote control? In Medina, Ohio, a family has been left homeless because someone lost the remote. Karen Ryan told reporters that the quick-spreading blaze that destroyed their home was accidentally ignited when her 19-year-old son used a lighter to look for a remote control under his bed. Not a bright boy. Karen said, "Up went the mattress. He tried to flip it over and put it out, but everything just went up." Investigators say in a panic moment that the fire had started, members of the family made a fateful decision. Chief Bob Painter said, "On the way out, they thought they were going to try to control some of the smoke damage, so they opened up some windows and opened up the door and propped it open." High school science classes would have been helpful here. "It actually works in the opposite with the wind, and it just turned the whole house into a chimney, feeding the fire with the oxygen, and it just continued to grow." Sadly, Karen said, "What's going to become of us? There's nothing left, there's nowhere to go, nothing that can be salvaged out of the whole thing. All because someone lost the remote." Not a bright family. Anyway, a man called a cab in Chicago, Illinois, and then passed out on the way to his destination. After about 10 minutes of unsuccessfully trying to wake him, the frustrated cabbie delivered him to the Rogers Park District Police Station. When police searched the man's bag, they found what was apparently a miniature meth lab complete with processed drugs with a street value of about $450,000. Police arrested Joseph A. Hoffman, age 25, and released the cab driver without telling him exactly what his fare was carrying. "They said they found a lot of bad stuff," the taxi driver said. He had $450,000 worth of meth, and he still couldn't stay awake? Wow. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? A little over a year ago, we spoke to Chris Aragon. Now, it was back on show number 0020. He was on then to talk about the website randomcreepyguy.com, that features a gallery of just that, random creepy guys who sneak into people's pictures completely unnoticed. Well, now he's back with a new website, and this one is called baconisbomb.com, and it deals with all things bacon. Welcome back, Chris.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me again.
Okay, so what's the deal with this bacon site?
Well, it's basically, like you said, a site that deals with all things bacon. Bacon creations that are both edible and not, but it's heavily focused on bacon photos and bacon videos. We've got everything from girls in bacon bikinis to a Bacon Obama rap video. I don't know who created that, but they submitted it, and it is a rap video dedicated to both Obama and bacon, most specifically Obama cooking bacon.
Now, it just so happens that, of course, I'm sure you're aware, this is not the only website out there that deals with bacon. On this program, back in July of 2010, we spoke to some of the guys from BaconToday.com. So I have to ask, how does your site differ from theirs?
That's a great question. I'm a huge fan of Bacon Today. It was, you know, perusing sites like that, and there's I think they had a video called Bacon and Rocketry on their site, which I was a huge fan of, that kind of got me thinking, you know, there's a lot of people that have this fascination and this kind of like online fixation with bacon. You know, I've seen people walking around with T-shirts that just say bacon on it. You know, everybody kind of loves bacon. You either love it or you hate it, but most people love it. And the difference between our two sites, I would say, is theirs is more informative, and mine, ours, is more entertaining. We've got, you know, more photo, more video-based, and I think they have more text, more recipes, more reviews, kind of, like I said, more educational.
Mm. Now, you said we. There's a group of you who put these sites together, correct?
Correct. There's myself, and I have two partners, one Brian Young, who handles the day-to-day management of both Random Creepy Guy and now Bacon is Bomb. And then Jonathan Garcia, who is our tech guy, who actually built both sites.
And the reason why I asked the question is I'm just sitting down here thinking about what those R&D bull sessions must be like when somebody puts their hand up and says, I know bacon. Like, what was the process here?
No, they're pretty off the wall, kind of goofy. We're all in different areas. Myself and Jonathan are actually both in L.A., but, you know, it's there's a lot of traffic in Los Angeles, so he's on one side, I'm on the other. We don't really see each other face-to-face too frequently. And then Brian, our third counterpart, is up in Northern California. And so we have a lot of Skype sessions, which involves spitballing random ideas. But as of this point, you know, we're really just want to focus on Random Creepy Guy and obviously this Bacon is Bomb site. We mainly went with Bacon is Bomb. We've got a plethora of ideas that we were looking to develop, but we kind of just like the name baconisbomb.com. Like, we thought it had a nice ring to it. And again, you know, everybody loves bacon, so we decided to try and capitalize on the audience we built with Random Creepy Guy and move it towards this new site.
Now, looking at some of the pictures up on the site, things that caught my eye, the baby bacon tuxedos, three kids dressed in bacon tuxedos.
Yeah.
Where did this come from?
That one's pretty amazing. That's actually, I've seen that one circulating around the web for a couple of years now, but I'm happy it found its way to our site again. That was pretty awesome, though. Just earlier today, I saw one of my partners forwarded me a link from Yahoo Answers where somebody said, can somebody please title this picture? And we had a plethora of, you know, just a ton of suggestions. I think there were like 12, but it had only been put up yesterday, 12 answers. With very witty captions, you know, some that were wittier than ours.
There's also a bacon lamp, an actual working bacon lamp.
Yeah, that one's pretty incredible. That guy had some foresight.
Now,
I can't imagine it would be good for too long, but it's definitely.
Exactly. Now, well, the bacon bra and bacon bikini do not necessarily sound that hygienic.
No. But they also happen to be our top two highly voted photos. So if that gives you any indication for our demographic, people seem to like bacon underwear.
Well, have you figured out, by the way, just who your demographic consists of?
Yeah, we're probably got a 60-40 skew towards guys aged between 15 and 29. and we're mostly prominent in the U.S., but right behind us we've got a lot of Canadian viewers, and then Argentina, of all countries.
Well, you know, up here in Canada, we do like our bacon, so that's not necessarily a surprise.
You got Canadian bacon. So.
Exactly. Now, I wanted to touch a little bit with some time we have on something that we talked about the last time we were on the program, and that is, of course, Random Creepy Guy. Well, Randy Creepy Guy would be something else entirely different. RandomCreepyGuy.com. You've taken this to new heights now. I understand there's some sort of show that's going to be taking place.
Absolutely. First, I think randycreepyguy.com, that should be our next site. That sounds like it's got a lot of potential there. But no, Random Creepy Guy, we've actually completed a web series. We've got 14 episodes. The nice thing about the randomcreepyguy.com, the series, the web series, is that it incorporates baconisbomb.com. In fact, the central plot revolves around baconisbomb.com and the creation of that site, its rise to popularity. And then there's two major groups, well, one group and one individual, one who owns baconisbomb.com and the other group owns baconisbomb.com. And through the course of the series, they have numerous interactions, you know, websites are stolen and taken from each other. And that's the central plot, basically. But, yeah, that launches on 222 on dailymotion.com.
Okay, so my question to you is what your three guys, I'm almost afraid to ask what your day jobs are.
That's a very valid question. Brian Young, the guy who handles the day-to-day, he works for an insurance comparison website, insweb.com. The technical guy, Jonathan Garcia, works for MGM. He develops all their websites. And then I work for a coupon site, savings.com. Mm. So, we're all in the online space.
And the reason why I ask is because, as you know, I mean, this is all very fun and all very funny, but there are some people out there, and sometimes they're employers, who don't necessarily have a sense of humor.
That is a really good point. And we've, you know, been very careful not to cross the line. Some of our not sister sites, but we're partnered up with peopleofwalmart.com, which is a fairly large humor photo site. And they've got a network of blogs. Some of their blogs that they're partnered with are definitely not very PC. And, you know, the bacon bikini kind of is walking that line. So we've been very careful not to, you know, fall into inappropriate kind of content for the sake of getting, you know, maybe more traffic. But as far as my employers go, they've been incredibly supportive and excited to see, you know, the following that I've been able to create.
Well, people can check out the websites. There's randomcreepyguy.com and, of course, the one we've been talking about, baconisbomb.com. I thank you very, very much, Chris, for taking the time to be on the program with us once again. I'm sure we'll probably hear from you again in the future.
I can hope. Cool. Well, thank you so much, Peter.
Chris Arrigan, one of the guys behind the website baconisbomb.com. You can find the links to their site by going to mine, thestufffile.com. Just click on the Stuff File program page and then the episode number for this show, which is number 0079, and you'll find all the information. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time for an idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
In Arlington Heights, Illinois, police arrested a 16-year-old boy for burglarizing a residence. But the strange thing is the boy is also being charged with cruelty to animals because he poisoned and killed three goldfish in a fish tank in the home. And he told police the reason he did this was because, and I quote, he didn't want to leave any witnesses. According to police, the boy and a 15-year-old accomplice pried open the door and stole a video game system, CD player, 30 video games, 30 DVDs, a BB gun, jewelry, and a safe. In order to eliminate the witnesses, they dumped hot sauce, mustard, ketchup, and spices into the fish tank. You know, they managed to kill the fish, and yet they still got caught. Why would you even think that goldfish could rat you out? One reason, and one reason only, You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0079. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com. And again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. And you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, number 0079. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.